In 4D, for those of you who don't know, topological order is a quite a new, exciting development in condensed matter, mostly theory, but there are also some experimental results. I guess you heard about topological insulators, maybe that's related. So it has all the ingredients of a nice theory in theoretical physics, because it can be quite playful, so there are some nice models, which we will see. And it is also quite deep. So it really goes down to the roots of the condensed matter theory. So I hope you'll enjoy the talk. So before I tell you about topological order in 4D, and actually even about topological order, I first tell you what I mean by order. So my definition would be that order is some structure in a many-body system. So we have many particles, and we see some structure emerge. And emergence is probably the defining feature of order. So by emergence, I mean that the equations of motion which describe our many-particle system, be it the second Newton's law or Schrödinger's equation for these many particles, don't really show us what the structure is. So if we write down the Schrödinger's equation for 10 to the 26 oxygen atoms and twice 10 to the 26 hydrogen atoms, it doesn't really tell us how ice is going to look like. So that's emergence of some order which is not seen in the equation of motion. Then the other defining feature is robustness. So if we change, let's say if we kick one oxygen atom from the ice crystal structure, then the whole structure is not going to change. So some robustness under small local perturbations. And also, maybe the most important and related robustness is universality, which bears the message that even if we change the details of the local interactions in our system, the structure of the system is not going to change very much. So we could imagine varying the interaction strength between oxygen and hydrogen a little bit, and we would still expect to get ice. Or we could even imagine replacing oxygen with sodium and hydrogen with chlorine, and we would get salt, and it's still cubic lattice. It still looks very similar. So that's quite exciting. But even more exciting things happen when we consider changes of order, and that's what is called the phase transitions. Roughly speaking, we have two kinds of phase transitions, but that's only very roughly speaking. There's the classical phase transitions in which the state, the order that we are considering, is a thermal state of some Hamiltonian. So we have Hamiltonian, and the state is just it's given by the Boltzmann distribution over the different energy eigenstates. And we can imagine varying the temperature, and the structure of the system is going to change, and that's what we call a phase transition. It's usually an abrupt change, and we'll see in a moment why it's abrupt, why is it a good idea to think it's abrupt. So we have classical. I mean, this classification is kind of, I don't know, it's maybe just my classification, I don't know, but classical. So we vary T or some other thermodynamic parameters, and usually what we see at a phase transition is a singularity of thermodynamic functions, let's say free energy, F singular, and also correlation length diverges, etc. But what I want to speak about mostly today is the quantum phase transitions. And now the state is not a thermal state. I mean, it is a thermal state. It's just a ground state. So we have a Hamiltonian, and our state is its ground state, which is just a thermal state at zero temperature, actually. So it's also a thermal state, but slightly different. And now we do not vary temperature because it stays zero, but we can vary some parameters in the Hamiltonian, and we can see, we can have a look how the structure of the ground state changes. And what is the analogy of the phase transition here? So the phase transition point is characterized by the fact that the mass gap vanishes, where the mass gap is the energy difference between the ground state and the first excited state. So that's where interesting things happen. And if we change the parameters in the Hamiltonian, so we write it, and we follow the ground state throughout this evolution of the parameters, then we completely lose track of what's happening to the ground state as soon as the mass gap shrinks to zero. Yeah, so gap is zero at the critical point, or critical line, whatever. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So now, yes, you definitely know some examples of phase transitions. They happen all the time. Water changes into ice. That's the example of the first one. We'll see example of the second one in a short time. So now, the crucial question to ask is what characterizes a certain phase, a certain order, be it in the classical or quantum. Yeah. And the answer to this, or partial answer, which was given by Landau, is symmetry. But I'll put a question mark here, because pretty much the story of topological order and the rest of this talk is going to be about this question mark. It will turn, it's actually not just the symmetry which characterizes a certain phase. So what do I mean by this? I mean that when we have a Hamiltonian with certain symmetry and we change some parameters, then the ground state doesn't always have the full symmetry of the Hamiltonian. And the different phases are labeled by the different symmetries, by the broken symmetries of the Hamiltonian, which are not preserved in the ground state. So for example, if you take the two-dimensional Ising model, the classical one, in which we have spin half particles sitting at the edges of a square two-dimensional lattice, and the interaction is ferromagnetic, so the energy of a bond is positive if the two is negative if the two spins are aligned, is negative if the two spins are opposite to each other, then this Hamiltonian, this energy function, has the global up-down symmetry. If we flip all the spins simultaneously, then the energy is not going to change. Nevertheless, if the temperature is low enough, then the ground state or the thermal state will not have this symmetry. So it will have non-zero net magnetization at a low enough temperature. But as we increase the temperature, there's going to be a point which is the critical point when the magnetization vanishes and the thermal state will gain again the global up-down symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So the different phases, the magnetized one and non-magnetized one, are distinguished by the non-vanishing and vanishing of a so-called order parameter, which is the magnetization. And order parameter is the other important or crucial ingredient in the extremely successful Landau's theory of phase transitions. Yeah, so order parameter is what we want to study, and we write our free energy as a function of the order parameter, and we use the symmetry of the Hamiltonian to write down the free energy. So this has been extremely useful, extremely successful theory until the appearance of topological order. Now let me turn to the quantum phase transitions and illustrate the idea a bit more, just so that you get used to, for those of you who are not really familiar with condensed matter, just so that you get used to the idea of quantum phase transition. So the system that I will consider is the one-dimensional Ising chain in a transverse magnetic field. So we have spins sitting at the vertices, or in a chain, just linear chain, one dimensional, and Zi, or I labels the spins, and Zi is just the sigma, Pauli sigma Z operator acting on that I spin. So if we just reduce, if you look at the one spin, it looks like this. And similarly, Xi is just the sigma X operator. So this relay is the Ising model. So there is some interaction which favors ferromagnetically aligned neighbors. And there is also the transverse magnetic field which points in the x direction. Yeah, so there's magnetic direction. And now let me illustrate the quantum phase transition. So the only parameter that we can vary now is lambda. So if lambda is very, very small, much smaller than 1, then this just reduces in the limit of lambda going to 0 to the classical one-dimensional Ising chain. And what is the ground? What we want to study is the ground state. So what is the ground state? It's going to be doubly degenerate. It's going to be either all spins up or all spins down, because that's the minimal energy state. So here we have a degenerate ground state, either all up or all down. So there are two of them. And this breaks the global up-down symmetry. Yes, so maybe I should say mathematically what the global up-down symmetry means. That just means that we have an operator, symmetry operator, which flips all the spin, which is just the product of the local xi operator, which flips the local spin, and yeah, just flips them all. And the statement that this is a symmetry is just that this commutes with Hamiltonian. So why does it commute? Mathematically, you can see it, because, maybe it's better to see it physically. It definitely commutes with this one, because if we flip all the spins, there are always two of them, so the local interaction doesn't change. But we also kind of flip in a plane perpendicular to the magnetic field, so the magnetic field also doesn't see the flip. Yeah, it's obviously commutes. And yeah, so these ground states in this limit do not conform to the symmetry, but if we consider the opposite limit, where lambda is really, really large, our Hamiltonian is just the uniform field in the x direction. And here we have, here the symmetry is not broken, because the ground state is just all spins will point in the direction of the field. So let me write it this way, where the local degree of freedom of this form means that just we have the spin pointing in the x direction. Yeah, so you can see that somewhere between lambda 0 and lambda infinity, it must happen that the symmetry of the ground state changes from the non-symmetrical one to the symmetrical one. If we, let's say, start in this ground state, we increase lambda, say, by adiabatic evolution, and then suddenly the mass gap must shrink to 0, and we are in a ground state which has this up-down symmetry. Are there any questions about this? Yeah. Okay. Let me see if I set everything I wanted. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in the statement is that the symmetry characterizes a particular phase, which means that as long as we vary the Hamiltonian in such a way which respects the symmetry, so we have some continuous change of Hamiltonian, but the symmetry is always retained. We always have a symmetry. Then we are in the same phase as long as the mass gap doesn't shrink to 0. And then the statement is that these phases are exactly characterized by the symmetry group. We can tell whether we are in different phases if we just look at the symmetry of the ground state. If we are not in the same phase, the symmetry will be different. And if we are, the symmetry will be the same. So the picture, according to Landau, is that the world of Hamiltonians and the ground states, or maybe just the world, bold statement, looks like that we have some regions in the space of Hamiltonians and the ground states which look like this, where the different regions are labeled by the symmetry. So the theory was extremely successful, and it really looked like in the 1970s that condensed matter was almost in the same situation as theoretical physics was at the end of 19th century, when even people like Maxwell were saying that, you know, we have all the all the theories, and we just need to apply them to understand how a world looks like. But as we know, in 1905, Einstein came up with relativity, and then quantum mechanics appeared a short time afterwards. Similarly, in the 1980s, following a study of high TC superconductivity, there came the discovery of so-called chiral spin states. And it was soon discovered that there are different chiral spin states, which obviously have absolutely different order, which look differently, nevertheless have the same symmetry. So they do not obey this Landau's classification or this theory. So they are completely beyond this language. And that's where topological order comes in. So I'll just give you the formal definition of what topological order is, and then I'll give you some examples and also some other properties so that we get some feel for what it is. So the formal definition would be that a state, psi, is topologically ordered if it's a ground state of Hamiltonian, and we cannot find any continuous change of this Hamiltonian such that the Hamiltonian is local at all times. So the locality is an important ingredient, because if we consider something more general than locality, we can as well just consider absolutely anything. Yeah, so in almost all theories of nature, we always have locality. So if we continuously change the Hamiltonian so that it's local, and we start in a ground state which is topologically ordered, then we cannot get to the completely factorized state. What is a completely factorized state? So we have some many particle system and some local degrees of freedom, and completely factorized state is one which is not entangled. So we can write it as a product of tensor product of A, etc., where these are just pure states on the local degrees of freedom. So we cannot get from here to here if this is topologically ordered without shrinking, without quantum phase transition. And so actually, if you define your topological order like this, I'm not erasing it because it's wrong, it's right, but because I want to enlarge this picture, and the picture of the world looks like this. So this is the old world of symmetry breaking, and then there are different topological phases, which are much bigger and actually unexplored. So nobody really knows what lies here, I think. Or is the classification somehow complete? Yeah, in a way. So these are the different regions which cannot be connected without the quantum phase transition by a local change of Hamiltonian. So the world is really much, much, much richer than we had thought. Okay. Yeah, another real-world example of topologically ordered phase is in a fractional quantum Hall effect, when the different filling factor states also have a different topological order. So that you have some idea that there are also some real-world examples which do not lie in this trivial space. But there are some experiments which actually explore parts of this one. So now I'll give you a different characterization of topological order, which can be also considered as a definition, but no one has shown that the definition which I mentioned before about the continuous change and this one which I'm going to give you now are equivalent, so no one knows. But this, I think, this is a bit more intuitive into what the states look like. So the topologically ordered state, Hamiltonian, is one when we have a degenerate ground state and a non-zero mass gap between the ground state and the excited state. And these different ground states cannot be distinguished locally. So if we have some big system, let's say spin system, you'll see an example very soon. And if we just look at a small piece of this, of our system, in the different ground state, then we cannot see any difference. We have to look at the system as a whole to be able to be able to say why these are different ground states, which is also the reason why it's called a topological order, or one of the reasons why it's called a topological order. Yeah, so now we would like to understand many things about topological order. For example, the classification, what is the analogy of group theory for topological order, yeah, because in the Landau scheme, the mathematical background is really just group theory. If you can classify groups, you can classify different phases of matter. But no one really knows what is the right what is the right mathematical language for describing different topological phases. I think Shelgang Kwan is working on some tensor categories, applying that. Yes, Shelgang Kwan is maybe the most important person in this area. I wouldn't like to offend anyone in the audience. Maybe there is a big expert in topological order by then. Yeah. So let's get an example. So the example I'm going to describe is a baby version of the system in 4D which I was studying, and this simpler system. Similar one is called a two-dimensional toric code. So consider a square lattice in two dimensions with n vertices. So n vertices. And now, the system consists of spin half particles which live on the edges of the lattice. So there are two n spins, because there are two n edges. Yeah, and also let's take the periodic boundary conditions. So this lattice actually lives on a two-dimensional torus. You can wind it like that, we get a torus. Yeah. And the total Hilbert space is just tensor product over the local Hilbert spaces, where each the local Hilbert space is a Hilbert space of one spin half particle, which is just c squared. And the Hamiltonian, which is the most important thing, perhaps, consists of two contributions. The first contributions comes from the so-called star operators. The second contribution from the so-called Plaquette operators. Now, the star operators, or a particular star operator, is a product of spin flips which neighbor with an edge. So here in this sum, we sum over all, oh, sorry, with a vertex. Here we sum over all vertices. And the star operator looks like this. So it flips the star operator here at this vertex, AS, flips these four guys. So it's an X, sigma X, or Pauli sigma X operator acting on these four. So let me write. There are four of them. And the Plaquette operator, BP, is a product over all sigma z operators acting on the edges which surround a particular Plaquette, where Plaquette is just square. And the second sum goes over all the squares, or all the Plaquettes. Now we would like to know what the ground state is, and in fact we were able to write down the exact expression. But let's first notice that we can actually diagonalize this Hamiltonian exactly, because all these operators commute with each other. So any two stars commit with each other, that's obvious because they're all X operators, these commute. All plug-S operators commute with each other by the same reason, and every star commutes with every plug-S because they either do not touch, in which case it's trivial, and if they do touch, they always share two edges, two spins. And because X and Z anti-commute, and they share two edges, then the two operators are going to commute. So in fact, these are the commutation relations. Our Hamiltonian is then a sum of all mutually commuting operators. That means that we can find an energy eigenbasis which also diagonalizes all of them. And in particular, the ground state will be D1, it will be the state, or S state, for which the eigenvalue of every A and every B is 1. Yeah, I should have said that because both A and B square to identity, because x squared and z squared are always equal to 1, the eigenvalues of A and B must be plus or minus 1. So the ground state is D1 for which all A and all Bs are 1. So ground state psi 0 satisfies, or let me write it this way. We will soon see that there is more than one ground state. So let me define the ground subspace, which is the space of all the space with minimum energy, space of all states with minimum energy. And it will be all states in a Hilbert space such that all A's and all B's act trivially on the state. We can actually construct it, and I'm going to give you the expression now. Let's first define the group G, which is the group generated by all the star operators. So it's a group of spin flips in which you're only allowed to flip a product of such stars. So in fact, this group consists of closed, or actually of boundaries of two-dimensional objects in the Joule lattice. If I can draw it, I can draw it here. So if we have an element of the group which flips this star and this star, that means we flip this edge, this edge, this edge, this edge, this edge, this edge, this edge. And we also flip this one, but we flip it twice, so we only flip these which I've drawn. So we flip all the edges which cut this closed line or closed curve, which exactly encircles the vertices which we around which we flip. So in fact, this is a group of all closed or actually, in the language of homology theory or in the language of topology, this would be the one boundaries in the dual lattice, just right here. And the size of the group is 2 to the n minus 1. So we have n different vertices, but they're not all independent, because if we take a product of all the A's, then we trivially get 1, because then every edge is flipped twice. So we can only independently choose n minus one vertices to flip.
Does that definition of ground state minimize the Hamiltonian necessarily?
Yeah, it does. Because so the possible energies is minus lambda times, and here's going to be a sum of plus or minus ones. And minus mu, sum of plus or minus ones. So it minimizes it. Okay, I didn't show that there exists such a state, sorry. It's true. But it is true. It is possible that such a condition is not possible, it is not allowed, but it is. So for example, it is not possible to consistently choose the A's so that their product is minus 1. You always have to choose the A's so that their product is 1, but such a choice doesn't violate this constraint.
Okay.
And it is the only constraint also. So that's the proof actually. Yep. And I promised you the state, the ground state. A ground state is going to be a uniform superposition of the whole group G acting on the all up state. Why is this the ground state? Why does it satisfy that condition? Well, if we apply any B to on it, then B commutes through all of these G's, because G is just a product of stars, and we know that every star commutes with every B. So the B will just commute through and hit this, but we know that any B applied on this is automatically plus one, because we have all spins up, which means that the product of four spins around the placket is always one. So that's good for the B's. Why is it also true for the A's? Well, that's the group property. So if we have a group, and in this group we multiply on the left or on the right by a group element, then this only induces a permutation in the group. So if we apply an A on this, we hit it, and all that happens is a reshuffling of this sum. So we still get the same state. But okay, so one more thing. So it is nice to represent this, think about it pictorially, as that the ground state is just a superposition of all possible one boundaries or of closed boundaries of flip spins in the dual lattice. So we can just draw all possible closed lines like that, and the ground state is going to be a superposition of those. But the important thing is that we do not get any closed lines which wind non-trivial around the torus, and that we are going to exploit in a moment. This is not the only ground state by trivial counting. We can just see that the dimension of the whole Hilbert space is 2 to the 2n, but there are only 2 to the n minus 1 independent configurations of A's and 2 to the n minus 1 independent configurations of B's. So the A's and B's can't possibly label all the states uniquely. So in fact, if you take the ratio of these two numbers, so this is the number of configurations of A's and B's, assuming that every configuration of A's and B's has the same degeneracy, we obtain that the degeneracy of the ground state, ground space, should be 4. So that we don't have all the information in the A's and B's, so we need more information. In fact, the information is topological. We can define some topological operators, gamma 1, which in the lattice looks like this. So it flips the spins which form a line which winds non-trivial around the torus. So we are using the fact that torus has non-trivial topology. And gamma 2 does exactly the same, but for the other non-trivial. And then if we apply this gamma 1 or gamma 2 to our ground state, we still get something which is a ground state. So. Why is this? Well, that's because the condition that we need for the commutation with the B is that the loops in the dual lattice are closed. And if we apply gamma 1 to this state, all we get is just that this is going to be now a superposition of all the loops which wind one around the torus in this direction. All the possible topologically different, or not topological, just different loops. and so it also it's satisfied for the B's and for the A's by the same reason as before. It's just a group property, except now we stay not in a group, but we stay in one coset of a group, of a subgroup in the group. Yeah. So we really have four ground states, and they have the property which I promised, which is that if we look at them locally, then we can't tell them, because if we just look at them locally, then they are going to contain closed loops and all of the same kind. But if we have to look at the whole torus to be able to see that in the psi 1 there are going to be only loops which wind round around the torus in this way. In psi 0 there are going to be just trivial contracted loops, and in psi 2 and psi 1, psi 2 similarly. There is another way to see why the degeneracy should be four, but why there are four states, and that is to construct two more operators. Yeah, sorry, I should have said that this operator flips the spin, so there's x sitting in each of them. We can also construct the analogous z operators, so there'll be delta 1, which is just this line going around the torus, where there is a z at every spin, and similar delta 2, which goes this way, so it's kind of dual. It goes in the perpendicular direction with the same number. And gamma 1, gamma 2, delta 1, delta 2, have the same algebra as two independent operators for two spin half particles. So sort of sigma 1, 2, x, sigma 1, 2, z. And these operators generate the full algebra of operators acting on the ground subspace. So actually the algebra of operators on the ground subspace is isomorphic to the algebra of two spin half particles, but the Hilbert space of two spin half particles is four dimensional. So this is another way to see that the ground subspace should be four dimensional. Okay. So here's a point of contact with quantum information theory, because we can store quantum information in these topological different states. So in quantum information, we would like to store a qubit, so to be able to remember a particular state in a Hilbert space. And yeah, we can do that just by taking some linear combination of these four, and we would like our system to be able to remember it, to stay in the state even if we apply some perturbation or increase the temperature. So unfortunately this doesn't have the property that if we increase the temperature, then we retain the information, we lose it, as we will see soon. But we do have the property that under some local perturbations, these different ground states will still be almost orthogonal to each other, or the tunneling amplitude between different ground states will be very small. So actually, the precise statement is that if we are, let's say that the tunneling amplitude, if we apply some local perturbation, then the tunneling amplitude from I to J ground state is going to go like, so of the order exponential on the size of a system. But the reason is that if we apply the local perturbation, then the transition amplitude is calculated in the perturbation theory. But if the perturbation is local, then in order to be able to change from one ground state to another, we have to do something topological. So we have to construct a continuous line which winds around the torus. From the local perturbation. So we have to go to an order in perturbation theory which is proportional to the size of the system, which produces this x to the minus l, because as you know, as you know, if we go to the L4 perturbation theory, all the smaller order contributions are zero. We get something which decreases, assuming the perturbation is small. Yeah. So in this sense, topological order is robust under local perturbations in this particular model. But yeah. So now let me define topological entropy. Because it looks like the structure in these things is really about entanglement. So if we want to measure the order and maybe construct order parameters analogous to the magnetization for a classical phase transitions or orders, we want to exploit the entanglement. So there is a quantity which measures the entanglement, which is called the entanglement entropy, and it is calculated as the following. We have some big system, let's say X, for example whole torus, which we decompose into two parts, A and B, and then we have some state whose entanglement we want to compute, so it's a pure state of the whole system, and we consider the density matrix of the whole system in this state. We find the reduced density matrix of the subsystem, which is just obtained by tracing over the degrees of freedom of the system B. So this is not a pure state if the state psi is entangled. And then we can calculate the entropy of this, which is just minus this trace rho A log rho A. So it's really just the entropy of the unpureness of this. I'm not sure if there is any word for that. Oh, impurity of rho A, which is all due to entanglement as long as psi is pure. Yeah. And if we do this calculation for the toric code model, which I described, we find that the entropy goes like, it's a very nice calculation due to my supervisor, but I unfortunately realized I don't have time to show it. Where NAB is the number of vertices which are on the boundary between A and B. So these are the vertices which share some edges with A and some edges with B. So in fact, if we consider some general topological ordered states, we find that the entanglement entropy has this scaling delta, where this is the size of the boundary between the system A and system B, minus gamma. Now beta can be some non-universal number in the sense that if we add some local perturbations, this beta will change. But gamma is universal, and it's positive, so it is a lack of entropy. And this is what's called a topological entropy. So this is somehow due to some additional structure of entanglement in your system, which reduces the entanglement entropy. So it's less entanglement than what we want. That point, yeah. So this is universal. And it's called a topological entropy. And the goal of my project was to calculate this topological entropy for in a four-dimensional Kitaev's model, which is four-dimensional analogy of the model which I have described. And the motivation for this was the following. So there is a conjecture about a connection between topological entropy and the decay time of a quantum state or of the qubit in one of these ground states. So when we have these states, these ground states, we would like to know what happens. We want to raise the temperature. I want to do that because we want to know whether we can still store the qubit if the temperature is non-zero. And we want to look at the quantity such as this. So we start in one of the ground states, and then we couple it to some thermal bath and see how it develops and see what the decay time is, whether it stays in the ground state or not, whether it's similar, etc. Or we can we can see how the amplitude, transition amplitude between two different ground states changes, and investigate the decay time. So in 2D, I'm going to draw it here. Oops. In the two-dimensional toric code, which I just showed, if we raise the temperature, then we have already seen that when T is equal to zero, this decay time of the ground state will go something like, will be exponentially suppressed by the size of the system. And it turns out that when we increase the temperature, this is actually no longer true. If the temperature is greater than zero, then this is of order one in the size of the system, which is bad. And then there is some scaling of temperature, which is just the Boltzmann, or delta is the mass gap. Yes, sorry, it's probably quite small. But this factor is not really important. It's this factor.
The decay time is the time it takes to decay, to go away from the ground state?
Yeah.
So for large L, in the first case, it equals to zero, the decay time seems to go to zero. So you wrote the time in ground state.
Yes, sorry, the tunneling amplitude, yeah, okay.
That's the property that it goes away from the
ground. Yeah, sorry. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sorry, I meant the typical time scale when something goes wrong.
Go wrong, okay.
Yeah. Why is this? Well, that's basically because if we increase the temperature, then we produce a uniform density of defects, and this uniform density of defects can accumulate around the whole torus and destroy the topological information. So actually, in our toric code, we have two structures. There is the structure of the A's, so the products of A's are just some closed strings in the dual lattice, and products of B's are closed strings in the normal lattice, because if we take a product of plaquettes, we just get some closed loops, like that. And the raising of temperature just introduces some defects. So not all the plaquettes, not all the stars will be one, but they can also be minus one. So there'll be some spins which are flipped, and plaquettes which produce minus one, and stars which produce minus one. And destruction of the topological information just means that these defects can conspire and produce some sort of a line which goes around the torus and destroys the topological information. And you can see that the statistics of this is sort of analogous to the one-dimensional Ising model, because what we need is to destroy a one-dimensional information. So if we flip some plaquettes, it behaves like the one-dimensional Ising model, and we know that one-dimensional Ising model has a transition at the zero temperature. So as soon as the temperature is non-zero, it's disordered. So this is what produces the failure at non-zero temperature. And in fact, when you calculate the topological entropy, you find that it's, let's say, 1 after some suitable scaling at t equal to 0, but it's 0 for all non-zero temperatures. So this somehow might be related to the fact that at non-zero temperature we have no qubit.
How do you define the topological entropy for t margin 0?
Oh, sorry. I'm rushing because I can see that time I'm running out of time. Sorry.
Is it some relative information?
So the entropy, the entanglement entropy at non-zero temperature will scale like this. So it will go with the size of the system now, because there are also thermal fluctuations. There is a contribution from the boundary of entanglement, but there is still this gamma. And the conjecture is that this is universal again. But the way to extract this is normally that you calculate this topological entropy and you take some superposition over subsystems whose boundaries and areas add up to zero. So these contributions cancel and you're left with some. That's actually how I calculated it in 4D toric code.
Right, but you say that it's a conjecture that at final temperature gamma is zero.
Is it true? Is it a conjecture? Is it known?
I'm sorry?
unfortunately, it's a conjecture.
Well, the offset zero temperature, the PCB lay.
Well, the offset at zero temperature, there are arguments that are dependent on some of the theorem. Whereas final temperature, I was not aware that you would still define this. Okay, but what if you complete this quantity, you see that it vanishes on the spot.
Yeah, exactly. If you do this, then it's zero here. So now if you go to 3D, where the model is exactly the same, we still have stars and plaquettes, except the plaquettes, there are more plaquettes now. There can be the plaquettes which live in this plane, then the topological operators, again, there are two kinds. There are the gammas and deltas. The gammas are now two-dimensional planes, and the gammas are one-dimensional lines. So the gammas have some of the statistics of the two-dimensionalizing model, and the lines have the statistics of the 1D-izing model. And we know that the two-dimensionalizing model, classical one, has a non-zero critical temperature. So actually, we cannot destroy the topological information in the membranes until we reach some critical temperature. So at T equals zero, we still get this tunneling amplitude. X minus L, then there is some critical temperature PC such that, and now we should distinguish the tunneling amplitude, the classical one and the quantum one. By the classical one, I mean the tunneling amplitude between ground states which were originally orthogonal. So that somehow corresponds to the classical computing, because in classical computing, it's enough if you remember the probabilities somehow. If you start with some ground state, some superposition, and you perform something, then the classical computation would be happy if you just remember the probabilities of the squares of moduli of the coefficient. But quantum computing is not happy with that. We would like to remember also the phases of these coefficients. So this classical time still scales with the size of the system, which is exponentially, which is what we want. But the quantum time, i.e. the tunneling amplitude between not necessarily orthogonal states, is now of order 1. So the classical information is preserved, but the quantum information is not between here. And when you go above the critical temperature, everything goes wrong. So just all the times are order 1 in the size of the system. And now I finally get to my work, which is pretty late. I'm sorry.
But what happens to the topological entropy?
Oh, yeah, there is. Topological entropy, that's what might be a bit intuitive, but necessarily. Topological entropy is 1 at 0 temperature, then it drops to 1/2, and it stays 1/2 at the critical temperature. So that somehow comes from the fact that the line topological information is destroyed, and then it is 0 above the critical temperature. So this region somehow corresponds to the ability to remember classical information, but not the quantum information. And in 4D, let me tell you what the model is. It is very similar, but it is not quite the direct extrapolation of the 2D and 3D model. The model is just that we still have star operators. And our spins do not live on the edges, but on the two-dimensional plaquettes, on the two-dimensional cells in the four-dimensional torus. The stars is the product of all spin flips which neighbor with an edge. There are 6 of them. And the BP operator is a sigma z operator acting on the 4 faces of a cube. So this is associated with edges, and this with cubes. Yeah, there are 6 faces. So there are 6. This is a product of 6 x-axis, and this is a product of 6 z. So this model is actually self-dual, which we also used in the calculation. And the topological operators are now both two-dimensional. So the gammas and the deltas live on the two-dimensional membranes, and there are 6 of them, because the second homology group of the four-dimensional torus is just z to the 6. there are six independent non-contractible membranes. And because they're both two-dimensional, the statistics, we expect these two Ising models. So that there'll be two critical temperatures. And below the lower of these ones, we'll remember everything. So even the quantum information is preserved. Between the two, only the classical one is preserved, because we only get half the information. So these are quite heuristic arguments. And above both, we have no information whatsoever. And my task was to calculate the topological entropy in this model to see the analogy. Let me just write it. PC1, even the quantum time, which is stronger, scales with this. Then between the two critical temperatures, the quantum time, quantum decays, the tunneling amplitude is large, but the classical one between orthogonal ground states is still exponential. And above even the classical one is of order 1. And my task was to calculate the topological entropy here at non-zero temperature. And the way we did it is that we exploit the self-duality of the model, which enables us to write down the topological entropy at some particular T, lambda, and mu as a sum from the stars. So this fact is actually not due to the self-duality. This is just a generic property of the system that we can write as a sum coming just from the stars and just from the cubes. But the self-duality then tells us that these two are equal. These two functions are the same up to some constant. So we can just limit ourselves to calculating this function, which we can do by using the trick that we so if we shift this to the left hand side, then the right hand side is in the.
What is mu?
Oh, sorry, yeah. It's here. Yes, on that deal again, to two parameters. Yeah, so if we shift this to the. Shift this to the left hand side, then the right hand side is independent of mu. So the left hand side must also be independent of mu because it's an equation which holds for every t lambda mu. So we can just take the limit of mu going to infinity. And, but mu going to infinity means that. Sorry, I did the other way. It doesn't really matter. It just means that we stay in the subspace where all the b's are equal to 1, the gauge subspace. So we do not have to explore the whole Hilbert space, and it makes the calculation much easier. Then we found a mapping to the four-dimensional Ising model. We just calculate this expression. You find some duality or the four-dimensional lattice. And there's a duality between the membranes and antiferromagnetic boundaries and the four-dimensional Ising model. And this has the critical temperature. And indeed, the critical temperature produces exactly the right behavior of the topological entropy. So this, which is that the topological entropy coming just from the stars, which is the same as D1 coming from the cubes, except rescaled by some different coupling constants. So it's 1/2 and 0. Then it stays constant until some critical temperature, dC1, and then it's 0. So here it's 1/2, here it's 0, and dC1 is I think 2.6. lambda. So it's proportional to lambda. The stronger the coupling, the higher the critical temperature. And this is calculated from the critical temperature of the four-dimensional Ising model for which there are simulations. So you can just use the numerical results. And if we superimpose these two things from the stars and from the cubes, then you get exactly the behavior which corresponds to the heuristic argument for tunneling amplitudes, which is that we have topological entropy equal to 1 at zero temperature. Then it stays constant until TC1. We have TC2. Here it becomes 1/2 and drops to 0. So here's the region where the quantum bit is preserved, this is the region where the classical bit is preserved, and here where all information is destroyed. And the hope for future is to actually be able to prove this conjecture in a greater generality, and to be able to say that full topological entropy, i.e. the one which we have at zero temperature, corresponds to quantum memory, half of the topological entropy corresponds to the classical memory, and zero topological entropy is no memory whatsoever. So these are different Wegener models. There's the paper, basically the founding paper of lattice gauge theory by Wegener, where he exhibits a class of different lattice gauge theories, and this is just the quantum version of one of them. But you can basically construct a Hamiltonian where which is in d-dimensional cubic lattice, your spins live on k-dimensional cells in the lattice, and the coupling is k plus 1 dimensional. Or the coupling can actually be also any dimension which is higher than the dimension of where the spins live.
So I'm wondering where the new regime that you found where quantum information is preserved actually comes from. So,
so
it's related to the fact that you promote the particle like operator to cubes or.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it works exactly the same as for the stars and the plaquettes. So here we have some higher dimensional stars and cubes instead of plaquettes. But still, the operators which get us from one ground state to another are products of X operators over some non-contractible two-dimensional membranes. And because these are two-dimensional, we have the analogy with 2D Ising model, which I'm not completely confident about. I'm more confident about the topological entropy. But it's true. It works.
Do you know if the resulting three-dimensional vision and its form just depends on the target code? Meaning that you cannot have topological quantum memory at a higher temperature?
I don't know.
So that
I've got no idea.
You've been looking at this particular model. So if this was generic, then you would be saying that only four dimensions you'd be able to have topological quantum memories that sound like this one.
So it is possible. So I don't think there is any counter example, but I also don't think there is a proof.
Counter simple.
Counterexample of the statement that there is no three-dimensional system which would have a quantum memory.
Absolutely.
At non-zero temperature.
So, but you didn't take any commitment. Mm-hmm. You just showed that if you have the qubit, you have the topological entropy. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you have?
But when you have the qubit preserved,
you
also have
the topological entropy.
So they get the same thing. So this can give a tool on how to prove maybe.